bit and talk a bit about Worcester, the context of Worcester at the time that Major Taylor lived here, and particularly the issue of race relations in the city at that time. In 1893, 2 years before Major Taylor moved to Worcester from Indianapolis, local resident Franklin Rice made the following blunt assessment about the city's black community and its race relations. This is what he wrote. The social condition of this race has not improved here during the past 40 years. In fact, Negroes are not treated with the consideration they were before the war, referring to the Civil War, of course, when Worcester was thought a paradise for the fugitive from oppression. He continued, there are a few well-to-do colored men here, but the majority are not prosperous. As Rice suggests, by the time Taylor arrived in Worcester, his home for the next 35 years, the city's racial atmosphere had noticeably worsened to people who remembered, particularly the Civil War era. Once a haven for runaway slaves before the Civil War and home to a deep abolitionist tradition, Worcester before and immediately after the war was known for its benevolent sympathizers, in the words of a Maryland slave who found freedom here before the Civil War. Immediately after the war, Worcester continued its tradition of benevolent sympathy for those who had suffered under slavery. Between the end of the Civil War and 1900, Worcester became home to at least 1,000 Southern-born blacks who sought a more complete freedom in the North. In fact, by the time Taylor came to Worcester in the 1890s, these Southern migrants had actually given the black community here very much a Southern flavor. The John Street Baptist Church, for example, the congregation that Taylor joined in 1898 was founded by Southerners, founded by ex-slaves, who instituted their own Southern-style worship here in the city. And it may be the case that Taylor's own Southern heritage, the fact that both his parents were born in Kentucky, might have influenced his choice to join John Street rather than the other Baptist churches here in Worcester. But despite Worcester's reputation as a haven for blacks fleeing from the South, by the late 19th century, Worcester's exceptionalism was beginning to fade, as Rice's comments note. The 1890s, the time of Taylor's arrival here, is often cited by historians as the beginning, historians generally of American history, as the beginning of the nadir of race relations after the Civil War. In the 1890s, Jim Crow laws went into effect across the South, while an informal Jim Crow became a way of life in the North. Black men also lost the ability to vote in the South, with the passage of laws that disfranchised them through literacy tests, understanding clauses, and poll taxes. Lynchings of black men also spiked in the American South in the decade of the 1890s. And historians think that something like 3,000 recorded lynchings in this period, roughly late 1880s through about 1900. This, of course, was a means for whites to keep blacks in their place. And at the same time, racial theories, which proffered scientific evidence of black racial inferiority, were widely taught in colleges and universities and embraced by average white Americans as well. So, even in liberal Worcester, as Rice noted, things were getting worse for the city's blacks. Never more than 2% of the total population, Worcester's blacks, like their counterparts everywhere in the United States, experienced blatant racial discrimination, especially in employment. As Worcester's manufacturing enterprises boomed in the late 19th century, and Yankee industrialists desperately sought workers and went to Europe and recruited them and constantly complained about labor shortages, most Worcester firms refused to hire blacks except in the most menial positions, such as janitors. As a result, the city's African Americans found themselves mired in the same domestic service jobs and unskilled occupations that they had held for years before. So how does all of this relate to Major Taylor? Well, in many ways, his experience as a black man in Worcester highlights many of the changes that the city and nation were undergoing in the late 19th century. Race relations certainly worsened across the United States by all measures, yet some places were still better than others, and certainly Taylor found Worcester to be far more liberal in its racial attitudes than Indianapolis, which gives you a sense of how bad things were, really, in other parts of the country as well. He found no such race prejudice, as he put it, among cyclists in Worcester, New England, as he did in the Midwest. And he participated in a number of bike clubs and races where he was the only black rider. While barred from training at the YMCA in Indianapolis, Taylor reveled in the fact that he had access to training at the Y in Worcester. Yet, as Andrew Ritchie points out in his biography of Taylor, from his early life forward, Taylor was Richie, quoted Mayor, said, had a remarkable and atypical relationship with the white world. Through his patron, Bertie Munger, Taylor worked as a machinist for Munger's Worcester Cycle Manufacturing Company. For other black men in Worcester at this time, a machinist's job was practically unthinkable. Through his athletic prowess, Taylor established himself as the exceptional black man, and in many ways the exception who proved the general rule of the city's race relations. Worcester embraced the talented young cyclist. As Taylor himself noted, I shall always be grateful to Worcester, citing the cordial manner in which the people received me. The local press regularly denounced the racism that Taylor faced in the cycling world to their credit, but notably that same condemnation never entailed, you know, a condemnation of the treatment of Worcester's larger black community. For example, the press's criticism never reached as far as the city's powerful industrial leaders who drew the color line in local industry. Similarly, the press defended Taylor, again to their credit, when he purchased a home in the all-white, newly developed neighborhood of Columbus Park, where he faced the wrath of angry white neighbors. Worcester is not the South, the Worcester spy noted. But the press did not criticize local politicians who, in these same years, refused to allow black citizens to get, you know, very secure city jobs, such as firemen, police jobs, very difficult to get teaching jobs at this time, despite the desperate efforts waged by black Worcesterites to get appointments in city services. In its defense of racist attacks on Taylor, whether in the cycling track or in Columbus Park, the local press always cloaked its righteous condemnations in Worcester's abolitionist traditions. But the defenses very much were for Taylor specifically, the exceptional black man, and not for the rest of black Worcester. Yet even a black man as exceptional as Worcester could not avoid the racism that had permeated his city and society, as we know, certainly from his examples on the racetrack, which is especially true at the end of his career. With his brilliant cycling career behind him, he, in many ways, was just another black man. Derek Jackson already pointed out his attempt to try to get into WPI, but WPI said it was because he didn't have a high school diploma, though others suspect, including Taylor himself, that his race had a lot to do with that decision. Several entrepreneurial enterprises also failed, Taylor was involved in, and he was reduced to working in his later years as a salesman and auto repairman, among other things. Many of these failures may have been due to personal shortcomings, but viewed in the context of the 19-teens and 20s, Taylor's struggles were no different than the rest of black Worcester and blacks around the country. The first decades of the 20th century continued to be very hard times for blacks in Worcester, even for the most highly educated and experienced. The color bar stood firm in Worcester industry long after the First World War dismantled it in other northern cities. Surveying the city's industries in the 1920s, a Clark sociologist found that roughly 31,000 people employed in Worcester's many diverse industries, only 40 of them were African Americans. Moreover, she found numerous examples of outright prejudice on the part of employers, as well as the fact that many educated and skilled blacks in the city worked in jobs for which they were clearly overqualified. And she mentions the example of an African-American man in Worcester who had a PhD who was running the elevator at Denholm's department store. It was the best job that he could get. The trained worker, she concluded, does not easily find an opening in the city of Worcester, and many simply go elsewhere to work. The city that once attracted fugitive and emancipated slaves for its reputation of benevolence now had a reputation for its paucity of kindness or opportunity. And that may explain why the Great Migration, which brought so many African Americans from the South to northern cities, pretty much bypasses Worcester. I mean, it just doesn't happen here because there just really wasn't much employment opportunity. Worcester, the birthplace of one of the earliest abolitionist movements, this Clark sociologist noted, apparently is failing to offer to the Negro an opportunity to earn a living as a free laborer. But Taylor never found a firm economic footing in Worcester after his racing career and ultimately left the city in 1930, reflected the difficulty that many talented blacks in the city experienced at this time. So far from being a promised land for its black residents, Worcester nevertheless provided Major Taylor for the space and support to launch his remarkable career. Although it had certainly fallen from its lofty heights as an abolitionist stronghold, at the turn of the 20th century, Taylor's supporters, especially the press, still drew on that heritage to defend his aspirations, his real awareness of that historical past. The tragedy, though, was that for a while at least, Taylor was only the exception. Born just as Reconstruction ended and white America began its long string of broken promises to freed slaves and their descendants, Taylor died in poverty in 1932, just as the first glimmers of what would become the modern civil rights movement began to appear on the horizon. Anyway, she was a forerunner of that movement, which would finally force the nation to live up to its constitutional promises to black Americans made before Taylor was born. Risking life and limb to do so, Taylor refused to live as a second-class citizen, continued to challenge the system, and in the darkest days of Jim Crow America, undercut prevailing notions of white supremacy through his accomplishments as a cyclist. The fact that despite all the roadblocks placed in his path, he could still write in his autobiography that he, quote, held no animosity towards any man, as testimony to a truly remarkable individual. Thank you.